Blog Talk Radio.
In a world of so much hate, crime and injustice, what we need right now is some universal love. Unconditional love.
Because it just always makes the show sound, well, just so cosmic. And that's what we are here, the Cosmic Citizen. This is Andre Traversa. Welcome back this morning to the Cosmic Citizen. And with me, of course, is my usual partner in crime, Paula Thompson. How are you, Paula?
I'm good, Andre. How are you?
I'm doing okay. Got the window open here. There's construction outside, but I'm not going to close it because it's going to be way too hot if I do. So bear with me, please, folks. If you hear construction, that's just that's part of live radio, man. You know, it's unscripted, technical glitches and all, live radio. Okay. Today, I'm a Cosmic Citizen. We're going to be talking about a very interesting topic, and that is sharing the Urantia book at a Christian college. Now, I thought this would be like a really ultra-conservative evangelical Christian college, but it really wasn't. From what I understand, it was more of a moderate to liberal place. But it's still an interesting and unique venue from which to share the Urantia book. And with us to talk about that is Jonathan Zoba. Jonathan is my friend Crystalline says, is a remarkable young man, 25 years old, found the book in 2003 online when he was talking to some friends of his about aliens. And then I think it was his brother that showed him the book online and got into it and got a bunch of other people at the college interested. Jonathan, welcome to the Cosmic Citizen.
Hi, glad to be here.
Good. So, Jonathan, tell me a little bit again about how you found the book. You were mentioning a little bit about this to me off the air. You said that you were surfing the web with your friends and you were talking about aliens. Was it your brother that found the book online?
It was actually a friend of my brother's.
Oh, okay.
We were kind of exploring the realm of aliens and alternative perspectives on ancient history. We had been reading Zachariah Sitchin's book, The Twelfth Planet, and we were coming from a Christian background, but we were kind of opening our minds a bit. And a buddy of mine, Andrew, who was looking up all this stuff online. He's a little more into the internet than I am. I think it was like on Amazon or something. If people that like this book also like this book, and the Urantia book came out, and he told my brother about it, that it had 700 pages about Jesus, and my brother promptly came to my dorm room and told me, and we looked it up online and started reading it.
So what is it? Now, it's interesting because some people who are into UFOs and all that don't like the Urantia book for a lot of different reasons. What was it about the Urantia book that stood out that made you want to continue reading it? I mean, it's quite a dense book, and, you know, people tend to either love it or hate it. If they start looking at the foreword, and they're like, they either start yawning or they're like, wow, this is fascinating. So what was it that really caught your attention?
Well, the core of my belief system, even though I was exploring, like, paranormal stuff or aliens and stuff, was still Jesus. Jesus was central to my worldview. And so we were most intrigued by the idea that it had every year of Jesus' life. And the kind of litmus test that I had in my mind for, okay, if this book is legit, I got to see, you know, what it says about when Jesus was 9 years old. Because that is the age that it would be hardest for me to imagine what the Son of God would be doing or be like when he was 9 years old.
Wow.
So I looked it up, and I was an art major and, you know, an artist and stuff. And so it just so happened that this first section I turned to when Jesus was 9 years old was a story of him getting in trouble in school for doing art.
Yes, yes, I do remember that. Drawing a picture in the classroom on the floor of the piece of charcoal, I think.
Yeah, and I could totally identify with that. But the difference between the way Jesus reacted and the way I would react is he thought it was unjust that he still obeyed his parents, whereas I was a little more rebellious than that. So after reading that, I was like, wow, this is a compelling book, regardless of whether it's true or not. So I just kept on reading from there.
So you started with the Jesus papers first. Is that correct, or did you go back then and read the front of the book?
Yeah, well, I kind of went from, I started with the Jesus papers, and then midway through Jesus papers, I was like, man, I got to see more background. Then I went to the history section, and then I staggered my way back to the beginning. But, yeah.
So I find it absolutely intriguing that in a Christian environment, you guys found this thing, and did you get some of the typical that's of the devil, and some like knee jerk reactions to it if you tried to show it to somebody, or were you all pretty much open? I mean, is the environment you were in fairly open minded?
Relatively speaking, I would say so. I mean, there definitely was kind of some of that reaction of people being, like, you know, pretty negative and afraid of it. Like, that definitely existed. But I think the main thing kind of about the religious and social climate was that people were pretty loving, and we valued friendships more than anything else. So people didn't really freak out too much because they knew my brother and I, you know, that we were, like, cool guys. So, you know.
And you were also, as I said before, this is more of a progressive Christian college, right? It wasn't like you're sort of, it's not like going to Bob Jones University or something, you know.
Yeah, it's definitely on the evangelical scale. It's definitely on the liberal side of the spectrum.
Well, that's, to me, that just is so encouraging. And I guess what I'm feeling is that perhaps it's more your generation bringing a new perspective. Would you say that's true?
Yeah. Well, I think what kind of defines our generation a little differently than previous generations is, to us, things don't have to be black and white. You don't have to be either for or against it. It doesn't have to be either of God or of the devil. You know, it can just be like, oh, huh, you know, that's interesting. And just kind of like putting one foot in and checking it out. And there's not as much of a, you know, intense knee-jerk reaction, as you'd say. It's kind of more of a passive open-mindedness that sometimes culminates in, you know, active, positive searching and definite belief, which is what happened in my case. After being open-minded to it, eventually, I couldn't be fair to my intellect and deny that the book was true. So,
let me ask you something. How long did it take you to read the whole book?
I think the first time through, about a year and a half.
Okay. That's reasonable.
Yeah,
I'm assuming you started with the Jesus paper, since that was the part that caught your attention right away.
I definitely started with that. And then, like, midway through, I mentioned I started the history section, and then finished the Jesus Papers, and midway through the history went to Local Universe, kept being like, well, wait, what's behind this? So.
Wow.
But, yeah, my grades definitely suffered my sophomore year because I stayed up late studying the Rancho book instead of doing my homework.
Well,
did it help you in some way?
Ultimately, it did. Because at first I was like, oh, this book is way more important than these other textbooks and stuff that I'm supposed to be studying. But then after observing, like reading about Jesus, how studious he was and everything, I was like, oh, well, if this book really is important, then that means I need to make my duties and schooling more important. And so in the end, yeah, I mean, my grades did come up later after being inspired by Jesus's stewardship.
Wow.
So a lot of people have that experience, Jonathan, where they're up all night. They're up all night reading the Urantia book, and I've heard that story many times that people who have found it, you know, have just almost stayed up around the clock reading it, just devouring it. And in my case, and I was 20 when I first found it, if I read it at night, it would put me to sleep. I mean, my brain would get so saturated with information, it just couldn't hold anymore. And I would, you know, I would sleep so well. But it took me 3 years to read it in its entirety the first time. And I read it from cover to cover. But like you, I was, oh, always in love with Jesus, absolutely enthralled with Jesus. I wanted to know everything about Jesus. And I had already had personal experiences with Jesus. So I was, you know, when I was a kid, I used to think things like, wow, the apostles were so lucky. They got to be with him. They got to sit with him and know him and talk to him for hours on end, how lucky they were. And so you can imagine what it felt like to find this book with the life and teachings of Jesus. And the first place I turned was birth and infancy.
Mm.
And I started reading about Mary and Joseph and the richness of the detail and, you know, that's not in the Bible. And I wanted to read that section so bad, but I decided that, you know, reading this book was the most important thing that I could probably ever do. And so I used the Jesus Papers as a reward for getting through the rest of it. And I even went back and started with the foreword, which I didn't understand a lot of it, but I read it still because I knew that it was going in on a very deep level. And I'm glad I did it that way because the book really unfolds, and the more, and I've told many people this, the more you read it, the more understandable it becomes, the more you read it, you know?
So. Yeah, well, and Jesus, I mean, you understand Jesus so much more having read the rest of the book, because it puts everything into universe context, cosmic context.
Exactly.
You know, Jonathan, one of the objections that a lot of Christians will have to the Urantia book is sort of, I think the most immediate objection is, well, why should we accept this account of Jesus' life, you know, as opposed to the Gospels? I mean, the Gospels have, you know, are verified by, you know, eyewitness, you know, Gospels are eyewitness accounts. You know, I mean, how is this any different than the Book of Mormon? Did that come to you, you know, because the Book of Mormon claims to have stuff about Jesus in it too. It claims that when he rose from the dead, he visited America and all this other stuff. Did you either encounter objections like that, or did you even think about that, you know, to yourself when you were reading?
Well, I was at a stage in my thinking where I had liberated myself from biblical authority about a year earlier. I still believed in Jesus as a historical fact. I believed in him personally and spiritually. And I was open, you know, I was open to whatever. I realized that, you know, the universe is a lot bigger than my mind will ever understand. And so the intellectual climate that I was in was I was uninterested in authority. Authority didn't mean anything to me. The only thing that was important to me was content. And so when I started reading the Jesus Papers, I was, you know, the question would come up in my mind, well, who wrote this? But then it would promptly go back to, well, you know what? It doesn't matter who wrote this. You know, this is speaking to my soul. Like, the content in this is so rich and so true. I was able to kind of pursue it just as, well, I don't care where it comes from. I don't care who wrote it, because what it's saying is so meaningful. And even if it's not true, it doesn't matter. You know, it's still nourishing my soul.
That's really funny, Jonathan, because that's exactly what Jesus says in the book. If you remember, he tells Nathaniel when he talks about the scriptures, he goes, you know, even if the story of Jonah, you know, was not historically accurate, and even if Jonah had never lived, still the truth in the story would, you know, which is about the love of God for the people of Nineveh, and the truth in the story would last. And, you know, of course, the Ramsh book makes a distinction between truth and fact. And it's kind of like, you know, maybe you're reading it kind of the way, you know, you're able to appreciate it kind of for the same reason people appreciate Shakespeare, you know, because of the timeless truth it contains. You know, even if, you know, and I think maybe the factuality maybe wasn't so important to you, right, you know, as what it was saying to your soul.
Yeah. But, I mean, I will say, though, it did culminate in a point eventually where I kind of had to come to conclusions about my belief about its origin. And, yeah, I mean, eventually it just made itself so evident that it was unlike any other text. I did kind of formally make the step in my thinking that, yes, I do trust in this book as an authority.
Wow.
You know, ultimately, all any of us can do is trust that. The book calls it our reality response. And in a way, it puts the responsibility right back on us to be the discerners of truth, because we want to add some kind of credibility to anything we read. And we often, the first question is, who wrote that? And so suppose it's Longfellow or some author that we all respect. Then we say, well, that has credibility because I know him and I like him. And he's written good things before. But really, that's not the credibility that it has. The credibility that any writing has is its integrity and its resonance of truth within the reader or the listener. And so, you know, the Urantia book really kind of forces that issue. I mean, and Jesus, you know, I've pointed out to people before that, and especially Christians, because I've had a conversation with them about the Urantia book many times, that if they were alive in Jesus' day, here is this man who was born as a babe of the realm, raised in a community, a nearby community, Nazareth of all places, went to synagogues just like everyone else, was taught by the same teachers, learned the same lessons, was raised in a Jewish family like most of his neighbors and friends. For all intents and purposes, he's just a regular guy.
Yeah.
But there's something about him, right? There's something about him. And so there must have been, well, we know there were two camps. There was the camp that said, I know him. He's not the Son of God. Come on. He, you know, I grew up next to his family. I know him. And then there was the camp that said, yes, yes, that's true. Those, for, you know, that perception is true, that he is just a man among men. But if you'll listen to him, you'll see that he's more. He's more than that. But first you have to give him a chance.
Yeah.
And we have that same faith step to take with the Urantia book. Jesus had no credibility save himself and the words of truth that he spoke. And the same is true about the Urantia book.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think that it's a faith step. You have to, the faith is that you have to decide for yourself if you believe that's true or not. But to do that, you have to give it a chance. And so many aren't willing, you know, to give something like the Urantia book a chance, which, you know, obviously from my point of view, that hurts me because it's so good.
Yeah.
I'd love for them to taste of its sweetness, to experience the magnificence of it. But you can't force people to do that.
Yeah, well, I mean, this dynamic is kind of exemplified. And I always get the biblical stories and the stories in the Urantia book mixed up, but when the guy is healed of blindness, he's been blind his whole life, and the Pharisees are like, you know, who did this, you know, and he's like, oh, Jesus, and they're all like, well, but, you know, by whose authority does he do these things? And the guy's like, I don't know whose authority he does what. All I know is I was blind and now I can see.
Right.
You know? And so he, you know, the Pharisees were all trying to figure out, you know, the authority of what's behind it. And the guy that was healed, you know, it wasn't important to him because, you know, he had a personal experience with Jesus. Yeah, it's kind of like the same thing with the book now. People are like all about, you know, by whose authority is this? And it's, you know, it's an old issue, you know. Jesus dealt with the same thing.
Well, sure, exactly. It's the oldest trick in the book. I mean, I was just going to say, you know, the Pharisees said, you know, accused Jesus of healing people by the power of demons. You know, he said, you know, you're using the power of the devil to cast out demons. And Jesus said, you know, that's ridiculous. How can Satan cast out Satan? You know, And that's unfortunately what, you know, some fundamentalists will say about the Urantia book. They'll say it's from the devil, even though the book puts down Lucifer and Satan and says, you know. But I guess what I would say is that I do agree with you guys that ultimately it's a matter of faith. That's true. Having said that, I do think that there are things that in the Urantia book that are verifiable, that are, you know, it's not blind faith. You know, it's not just faith. It's not just a leap in the dark. You know, it's there are, first of all, the Urantia book is very logical. It's consistent, so there's that, and there's evidence. There's evidence for things in the Urantia book being true. We talked to Halbert Katzen on the show before, who has his UB the News website, which points out that there are things, the Urantia book says that are verifiable scientifically. I guess what the other thing that's interesting is, and we can talk about this a little more, is the Urantia book also, even though it critiques certain Christian doctrines, it also builds on the Bible. It builds on the Gospels. And we can talk about that later on. But I want to ask you a little bit more, Jonathan, about what happened, because I heard that you kind of started a community of fellow readers kind of at school. Is that kind of what happened? I mean, that was kind of that's kind of what I've heard from other people.
Not quite. I wouldn't quite describe it that way. My brother and I are both readers, and we have a community. And so people, I mean, there's no one else really besides my brother and I who have kind of taken that leap that we're talking about. But there is a lot of openness to it. And I have, you know, read sections with it with my friends, or my friends have read part of it. And it's, you know, it's kind of a part of our dialogue, you know. It's in the consciousness of our peer group, and mm-hmm. we, you know, we're trying to live its ideals, and it's kind of like my brother and I are trying to live the ideals of, you know, what Jesus presented, the way he presented, and a lot of our friends are into that too, and, you know, maybe, like, intellectually they're not ready to digest the book itself, but they're into what we're into, sort of thing, you know, at least in living and behavior. And so, and the thing is it's not really new concepts, you know. There's, within biblical teaching, there's a lot of the fundamentals of the teachings of Jesus. And so I'd say it's more of we're all into Jesus, you know, like more Jesusonian, and people are aware that we're into the book, and we read it together sometimes, and people are receptive to it. So it's kind of a unique level of tolerance that I've seen. I don't quite know how to categorize it.
Let me ask you this too, Jonathan. You know, a lot of people bitch and complain about your generation. Say, oh, you guys are just a bunch of, you're a text messaging generation, soundbite generation. I have to admit, I do that myself, and I'm not that much older than you. I'm 39, but, you know, I was just reading an interesting article. It was kind of a satire. It was called Twittering the Constitution, and it was a guy who took the Constitution and kind of put it into little Twitter acronyms, you know, like Bill O'Reilly's, you know, it was pretty funny. But anyway, you know, I guess my question is, you know, do you think that there are people, do you think there are a lot of people in your generation that are ready for a dense book like this? I mean, do you think that they have, I don't mean to sound patronizing, but do you think they have the attention span, you know, to really read, I know you did, obviously, but do you think there are actually quite a number of young people who would be able to read a dense book like that and not lose, because, you know, there is something to be said, you know, I hate to say it, for that criticism of you know, of your generation being kind of, you know, just text messaging, you know, here or there, you know, not, you know, kind of soundbite here, soundbite there. And do you think the hunger for truth is deep enough in your generation that they would be willing to immerse themselves in something as old-fashioned and quaint as a book?
Well, I haven't met too many people in my generation that, you know, are actually willing to read the whole book. But, I mean, I will speak to, at least in my peer group, and I would imagine in others, I mean, there is a response to this whole, you know, instant message, instant gratification sort of communication, short attention span. Like, we're not unmindful of it the way that you guys are, you know. It's not like we're blindly, you know, immersed in this electronic 1 second, you know, soundbite or whatever world. And there is an active response, at least amongst my peer group, and I would imagine others, to, you know, to read books more and then to talk about books. And so, yeah, I mean, I don't think it's like a crisis or anything.
Okay,
you know?
Good. I'm glad to hear that. I'm glad to hear that. And I trust what you're saying, because what do I know? I'm just an old fogey. So go ahead.
Well, it's obvious that a lot of people are listening to books now, and there's more than one way to read a book or assimilate a book now, and that's a good thing. I mean, we just found out that you found it online. And, you know, considering that we've done so much work, I myself have spent hours and hours and hours and hours on truthbook.com. And my hope was, I mean, Mo and I both took a look at the potentials of the Internet back in the late 90s. Oh, my God, this has the potential to reach millions of people. And, you know, Jesus said, you know, get better at whetting the appetite of your associates for truth. So I think that everything that brings people back to that the entirety of that volume is a good thing. If they read it all, if they read parts of it, it's all good. Hopefully, they'll ultimately read all of it. And hopefully, books won't go out of style. I don't think, you know, now we have Kindle readers, which is really cool. I mean, you could literally take 1,000 books with you everywhere you go, in your pocket. You know, just because they're not paper, and I don't think paper is going out of style anytime soon. I still think people like to snuggle up with a good book, but it's just interesting that, you know, for instance, last year, I think over 250,000, if I'm correct. I don't have David Cantor here with me to give me the right statistics, but as I recall, over 250,000 audio files of the Urantia book were downloaded from the fellowship site. That's astonishing. So the book is getting heard and read and sampled in unprecedented ways. And I have to believe that the revelators knew that that would happen. And, you know, for sure, the written word is not going away. Texting is the written word. My daughter texts all the time. I mean, it makes sense to me that here comes this big blue book in the age of communication. that we tell each other about. That makes perfect
yeah.
sense.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's comparable to the advent of the printing press. You know, like the book talks about the printing press, and the internet is kind of like, it's the next step, you know?
Well, and everybody's talking and everybody's sharing with each other. It's like we're in constant communication. Look at Twitter. And in some ways, that's, you know, off-putting to old fogies like me who, you know, I get tired of all the new gadgets and having to learn another new gadget, but I know your permission. And my daughter, May Lee, who you might have seen at the conference a couple weeks ago, she's as at home with every new gadget as, I mean, it's almost like she's hardwired for it. It's supposed to happen.
Well, my concern is not so much, I mean, I think it's great that there's all this opportunity for communication. My concern is, you know, what's going on that's really of substance? Is it real communication? How much of it is really in-depth communication is, I guess, my bigger concern. But Jonathan, let me ask you this. I'm being a cranky old fogey again. So, Jonathan, let me ask you this.
Let's hear it.
Let me ask you this. Since you have biblical professors of biblical studies and who were Bible scholars at the university, did you introduce the book to any of them?
Yeah, I mean, all the Bible professors are at least aware of the Zilber brothers and their Your Answer book. My brother was a biblical studies major.
Oh. Okay.
We've talked to them about it, and none of them have really. Well, I mean, in some ways, their career would kind of be on the line if they
were
to actually be open-minded to it. But in a year or two later, I think after I graduated, I did hear from a couple Gordon students that one of the Bible professors used it in class as they're doing an example of extra-biblical perspectives on Jesus,
mm-hmm.
but using it as an example of, you know, heretical text or whatever. So, but either way, yeah, it was assigned reading, and I forget what class, some theology class.
You know, one of the things that I've talked about on the show a lot, and maybe I'm repeating myself over and over and over, but one of the things that makes talk radio good is that you tell them what you tell what's that phrase? You tell them what you told them, and you tell them again, or whatever that. I can't remember how you saturate the airwaves with certain points, because
okay.
there are certain things I really want to get across. And one of the things that I am very concerned about, Jonathan, and I was telling you this before, well, several things. There are a lot of Your Answer readers I know not only do not know the Bible, but they don't care about it, which really frustrates me, because the Your Answer book uses the Bible more than any other book. And, you know, I don't mind if someone's ignorant of the Bible, but the fact that to not care and think it's not important, to me, you know, there's so many reasons why I object to that. But I guess one of the things, let me just ask you this point-blank question. I remember talking to you at the conference in Boulder and telling you about how I was, you know, my soul has been nourished a lot by Christian fellowship, a fellowship with evangelicals. I don't agree with all their theology to see some of the virtues in their communities. Do you think that we, as Your Answer Book readers, what do we have to learn from more, should we say, more traditional Christian communities? What is it that we can benefit from? You know, if we humble ourselves and say, okay, you know, I mean, it's very easy for us to say, oh, we've got this revelation, we're better than all the rest of the folks out there. You know, what is it that we can learn from, you know, Bible-believing Christians?
Well, I think one thing that the Urantia community is lacking is a culture. It kind of has its own, like, fledgling culture, but what Christianity has is, you know, a long heritage of, you know, values, mores, you know, ethics that have, you know, persisted pretty well in tight-knit communities. And so I guess what I see is when I look at the Urantia community and I look at, compare it to some of the more progressive Christian communities, if you were deaf or you were unable to hear what Christians or Urantians were talking about, I would probably wager that some of these Christian communities would be considered to be of a more progressive religion than your answer community.
What do you mean by that?
In the way that it translates into actual living and lifestyle. So my point is like, sure, maybe we have a superior intellectual system, but it doesn't necessarily mean that it has translated into an actual culture, you know, an actual technique of living. And so I think that we, you know, even though we have a revelation in an intellectual sense, we don't have a living revelation in a personal or cultural sense the way that we did with four previous revelations. We still have to evolve a culture, you know, we still have to evolve a lifestyle. And I see the Christian culture as some facets of the Christian culture or strands of it to be being the most progressive as far as I've experienced. And so I think it would be very beneficial for us to work with and learn from the Christians and their kind of tried and true social institutions, you know, that they've been cultivating for evolving for thousands of years, and you know, which we inherit.
Well, and the Rancho book tells us to not forget our religious riverbed, and you know, I think that's part of what you're talking about. Be more specific, because you know, I think what you're saying makes a lot of sense, but let's take it out of the abstract. What specifically can we learn from a lot of Christians about lifestyle? I mean, give us a specific example.
Good old morals. You know, there's a lot of truth to some of the more traditional Christian morals that, I don't know, because of like being progressive or extra liberal, we kind of let go of. And
yeah,
you know,
I would agree.
Things like moderation. You know, just being moderate in our lifestyle, and I don't know. I guess like, I don't know, the value of marriage and relationships, but I know the Christian community has just as much of a divorce rate as
right.
any other community. Just, I don't know,
but
simple
you know what, just
love.
Just because you failed to live up to your own standards, that doesn't make the standards wrong either, you know.
Wait, what did you say?
We've had a couple of questions, too, on the board, and the board moves pretty fast, so I kind of want to get those in if I can. Jonathan, and the one was, do you think we should create a church? And the other was, how do you feel about openly discussing the Urantia book and spreading the gospel of Jesus?
Well, yeah, I don't think we can create a church. I mean, the book talks about, you know, the growth of cults. You know, they can't be created. They only happen unconsciously.
Right.
But as far as, like, the spreading of the book or whatever, I think that there's the same habit in the Urantia community as there was in the early followers of Jesus to spread more of a religion of the book, a religion, you know, or a religion about the book, a religion about Jesus, instead of teaching the religion of Jesus or the religion of the book.
Yes.
And so it's not a priority of mine to spread the book or to get people to believe in the book or even to read the book. That might be a byproduct of mm-hmm. people, you know, learning and loving and cherishing the gospel, the real gospel. But what I think is more important is, I mean, you look at how Jesus treats other people, how Jesus relates to other people. He uses their scriptures. He lives in their culture. He has, you know, way more information in his mind than we readers have. You know how often we think, oh, if only I could tell this person this or that. You know, Jesus knew way more than we do, and he was so restrained in the way that he communicated with people. And I think we as readers have a lot to learn from that and how we deal with Christians. Like, our objective shouldn't be to convert them to the Urantia book. If we're able to have a mutual spiritual experience and never mention the book, that's enough. In fact, that is the ultimate end. you know, not intellectual conversion.
I agree with you on this, but it's very interesting, Jonathan, because I feel like I hear there seems to be so many false dichotomies. And on the one hand, you've got people who say, well, you shouldn't spread the book, you should just spread the gospel. That's more. And you got other people who are like, no, we got to get the book into the hands of as many people as possible. And I guess to me it's just a matter of it's this case-by-case situation, you know. I mean, this is sort of a cliche, but if you feel the Spirit leading you to talk to share the book, then do it. If you don't, share, you know, then sharing the gospel is enough, you know, or living the gospel is enough. You know, and I think that it goes without saying, or it should go without saying, that living the gospel should be one of the things that we do regardless of whether we're discussing the book with people or not.
You know, for me, the book holds up a religion. And the religion that it holds up, Jesus describes very well in his discourses on religion. One he calls the religions of authority, and the other he calls the religion of the Spirit, which is the religion of personal, spiritual experience. And I think that that is the religion that the book holds up. And in my experience, that is what people are ready for. They are ready to have an experience with God. They are ready, as Jesus told his apostles, to find God in themselves, of themselves, and for themselves. And to know God, to have a real relationship with their Heavenly Father. I think people are ready for that. I think they're tired of being held apart from deity, being told that they need middlemen and they need to do thus and such in order to gain favor with God. And I think that's what we're called to hold up. A relationship with God, friendship with God, sonship with God, which is the gospel, right? I mean, you are by faith the sons and daughters of God by faith. Jesus said at one point, the child has not to earn the right. The son has not to earn the right of sonship. What father makes his child earn the right to be called my child? You know? And I think that the religions of authority, I mean, Jesus lays it out so clearly in the second discourse on religion. He says that they've, you know, bound these people up in dogmas and creeds and crystallized, fossilized, you know, left them in the past. And he at another point calls it traditional barrenness. And over again he said that he came to set the spiritual captives free. And only, you know, in another place the book says, beliefs fixate, but faith liberates. So it's these beliefs that are handed down by religions of authority and their heavy-handed ways of dealing with people, making them afraid, enslaving them to meaningless traditions. And, you know, obviously you can't go and tell a religionist that. You just can't.
Yeah.
But you can hold up the religion of the Spirit, and you can hold up friendship with God, and you can hold up sonship with God.
Yeah, and the last thing we need to do is impose a 2,000-page burden on people to accept the gospel of Jesus, you know, to not make it in the same way that Christians say you have to accept the Bible, you know, to be saved. You know, if we can celebrate spiritual unity and not put the Urantia book as a potential barrier for whatever reason people aren't ready to accept it, that we can still find spiritual unity and recognize our sibling, you know, the fact that we're spiritual siblings, regardless of whether or not, you know, they accept this big book, you know?
Well, you know, and I agree with what you're saying, Jonathan. I think we need to be careful too that we don't turn our movement into a religion of authority. And
yeah.
Really, I know people who are Urantia book fundamentalists. I mean, I was talking to a guy recently, and I think he was kind of kidding to some extent. I mean, well, he was kind of overstating his case on purpose. But I thought it was kind of ridiculous when he was telling me, you know, that you should always read the book from the beginning to the end, and you shouldn't just skip around in the book, and all, you know. And he was trying to justify it by saying, you know, that the revelators tell, you know, give us they go from the complex to the simple, and we should do the same thing. Well, maybe that is the best way to read the book, but that doesn't mean everybody's going to do it that way. And for us to insist that they do is pretty ridiculous, you know. But the thing, I guess, but I'm going to make a statement that I think is maybe, you know, again, it's one of my many controversial statements. You know, throughout most of history, religion and authority was the big problem. You know, we had, you know, as Paula was saying, people were bound by tradition and enslaved by, and in many parts of the world today, that's still true, okay? But I think in some ways, I think there are certain quarters where we have the opposite problem. We have a lot of kids who are raised with nothing. You go to Europe. Europe has become extremely secularized. There are a lot of kids who are hungry. They're hungry for absolutes. They're hungry for truth because they haven't been raised with anything. Sometimes I feel like we're fighting old battles that have already been won in some respects. I mean, you know, I don't want to. I mean, I have a side of me that's an adolescent rebel, but you know, comes a time when I need to grow up and say, you know what, I need to stop fighting this adolescent battle and recognize, you know, I don't need to keep fighting the religions of authority the rest of my life. You know, there are some people who don't have any sense of authority in their life. And I'm not saying we should appeal to authority. I guess the point I'm making is there are kids, for example, growing up today without any direction. I mean, have you found that to be true of some people in your generation, Jonathan, of people who've been raised with nothing? And, you know, they would love to find some kind of answers because they're wandering around in the philosophic chaos that the book talks about.
Yeah, I think there's some truth to that, but I think more than that, what has unconsciously happened, and the book talks about that we have traded ecclesiastical authority for secular authority.
Yes, I agree with that, yes.
And a lot of people are unconsciously bound to basically secular formalism, you know, political correctness.
Yeah, absolutely.
Has
absolutely.
Really come to oppressively dominate people's thinking, and so I think in some ways I don't know if it's worse. It's probably not worse, but there's still a battle to be fought. Now it's not the church or the religions with the authority. It's the scientists and the secularistic
absolutely.
Universities that have the authority in informing people's worldview. You know, the kind of the scientists are the new priest class of our generation.
Hey, you guys, we have a call. Can we take a call?
Sure.
Yeah.
Talk.
Hello.
Hey.
Hi.
You are with us. It is Crystalline.
Hey, Crystalline.
I'm with you. Hello. I'm trying calling in on Skype. How's the sound?
We can hear you.
Hi, Jonathan.
Hi, Crystalline.
Really nice to have you on today. I had just wanted to comment on a topic you were talking about a few minutes back about, you know, religions of authority and, you know, how much we have to sort of overcome. But it sounded from one of our discussions like your experience was probably more similar to mine in that, you know, not all Christian groups are really authoritarian. And there are quite a few that are quite progressive and that are really practicing the living religion of the Spirit. And at least in my experience, that was absolutely true. And I think we have to not assume that sort of all Christians fall into the same kind of categories.
Yeah.
Well, you know, when you get these religions that are built up on authority, I think that what happens is you have the people who are, you know, in some ways invested in the authority, like the clergy, for instance, or the administrative end of it is very much invested in keeping this authority. But I think that there are a lot of communities on the lower levels and even at the grassroots who aren't so invested in that. And truth be known, you know, they aren't heavy-handed with their fellows. In my experience, I have found a whole variety of Christians that are very liberal in their thinking in terms of, you know, they don't think God is mad at them or mad at everybody. They have very interesting, you know, points of view. They may not go to their pastor and tell their pastor that, but they hold their own points of view, and I think that's very healthy, really. And I know,
yeah.
Kathleen, you were raised in a mission in Ghana, and certainly the village was not like that, right? In your experience, the religious communities in other parts of the world aren't so heavy-handed. Is that true?
Absolutely, that's true. But also, I was talking about the actual mission community, the people who were there as missionaries were, for the most part, really living their faith. You know, they were really making every honest attempt to sort of spiritualize their personality, as the Urantia book would describe that process, and also to, you know, really trying to make a difference in terms of service and dedicating their lives to helping others. There wasn't very much ecclesiastical involvement at all, actually. It was about practical, you know, day-to-day problem solving and helping others improve their quality of life.
Do you think that was more because of the situation people were in?
Well, I'd like to hear Jonathan's experience about that, because he shares that common background with me, and that he also lived outside of the United States with his religious community doing as a missionary kid for a while.
Yeah,
what do you think, Jonathan?
I think that those, you know, authoritarian disputes within Christianity, between Christians and Urantians, and within the Urantia community, are most prominent when there is a lacking of true spiritual substance. Because those intellectual or authoritarian differences are exaggerated in their importance when there isn't a real living religion behind them. And so when, like, an example I had recently when I was in Honduras working with a Christian missionary, I didn't agree with him intellectually with his theology, but the way that he was living, he was doing this agricultural program, I believed in that, and I wanted to help him with that. And so it's funny, you know, as it turned out, you know, while I was there, he found out that I actually have vastly different theological beliefs, yet we ended up, you know, next to each other, you know, digging the trenches together, you know, whatever. Our different theological streams that we have followed have brought us to the same place, to the same behavior, to the same action. And so he actually ended up getting engaged, and he was going to leave his project for 7 months, and he was looking for people to come to help. And as it turned out, I was the only one there. I was the only one stepping up and being like, all right, yeah, I'll see over your project. And it was kind of this funny moment where we had this really, really intense theological discussion where our differences were made very evident. Both of us weren't totally mature in the way that we dealt with it. But it kind of concluded with him being like, well, you know what? I don't agree with you, Jonathan, but I have faith that God is in control. And he left his entire mission project up you know, left it with me, Yuranchin, because both of us knew that we have much greater in common based on our lifestyle and the way that we live, because we both had enough real religious substance that theological difference just wasn't really that big of a deal.
So this guy knew that you were a Yuranchin book reader?
What's that?
This guy knew that you were a Yuranchin book reader?
Yeah, yeah, he knew. We talked in thoroughly about it.
The reason I ask is because I find myself, if I'm talking to someone who is pretty set in their theological ways, maybe it's a matter of discernment. I don't always tell people about the Yuranchin book, especially if I'm talking to somebody. It's kind of like in the Yuranchin book where Nathaniel is talking to Jesus about the scriptures, and Jesus says, "I'll tell you the truth about these things on condition that you don't repeat it to your brethren who are not prepared to receive this teaching." You know, and I go to a Christian Bible study every Tuesday night, and I have some very dear friends, and I hate to say it, these are very good friends of mine, but if they knew I was reading the Yuranchin book, they probably would want nothing to do with me. It's really sad, but it's true. But I have to keep that in mind and recognize that that's all they're capable of handling right now. So I guess I was just kind of, I gave you a little surprised. Maybe I don't know the guy, so maybe, what led you to tell him about about the Yuranchin book?
Well, it just came up naturally. I had been working with him for like 4 months, and we were having a conversation while we were planting, coconut trees. And the conversation was, what's the weirdest thing that you've experienced? Or like the most, you know, supernatural thing you've experienced? And he asked me, and I was like, well, this book that I read, the Yuranchin book, I think it's the craziest thing. You know, and so then that kind of precipitated the conversation. So, I mean, if it comes up, you know, I'm happy to talk about it.
I also find that the conversation comes up, you know, really quite naturally when you're sharing your personal religious experience with others in a very open way. And that seems to be really effective for me in avoiding what I would consider sort of theological bashing each other, but just talking about the reality of your experience with knowing God and that the deepening of that relationship. And also I realize too that my experience and probably yours also, Jonathan, was in a more sort of liberal mission community, as opposed to a really fundamentalist type of community, or one that was like the way you describe, Andre, that, you know, if they found out you were reading the Yuranchin book, you'd probably be kicked out, you know.
And make no mistake, these things do happen to people. People have lost their jobs. In congregations that they have served for years and years and have been beloved members of simply because they admitted to somebody that they read the Yuranchin book. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that is a reality, and I think people are justifiably concerned with that. But also, I think, and Jonathan, maybe you can speak to this, it seems to me like probably everywhere people of your generation go, you're being courted by people of my generation. Would you say that's true?
What do you mean by that?
I mean that you're kind of given an honorary berth for being the younger generation and being willing to get involved with something.
I guess I'm not sure, with churches, for example, or
yes,
can you give me an example?
For instance, I know for a fact that in the Yuranchin movement, everybody is thrilled to see young people reading it. Everybody I know, especially in my generation, because we came into it in a big wave, and then there has been nothing are very little. And then to suddenly see young people like you finding it and reading it is thrilling. But I also know that churches are experiencing a great deal of, they're shrinking. There's a great deal of shrinkage, let's say. And so, a young person like you comes along is willing to do mission work. I mean, is that accurate, or would you say, or do you see a lot of people your age getting involved in a lot of things religious?
Yeah, well, I think what's diminishing is like the more like formalized forms of things.
Yeah,
the service value still exists in people, in the tradition and the heritage that we have. But it's just kind of like finding like new and different venues. It's just people aren't as into sitting in, whatever church, and just like the old forms just aren't as appealing anymore, maybe, but it doesn't mean that the values aren't still there. And so, I mean, at least with my crew out here, I mean, we're definitely all seeking, new channels and forms of service and worship. I think for the most part, the older generation is kind of stepping back a little bit and being like, okay, do your thing. And it seems to be working out pretty well.
It's interesting, Jonathan. I think that it's funny, Paul. I basically agree with you guys both that there's an institutional religion seems to be shrinking. Although I think the need for community, though, is still quite strong. But I think that having said that, one thing I will say, though, is that statistically this is true. The churches that are growing, interestingly enough, tend to be more conservative churches, for lack of a better word, evangelical fundamental churches, and the mainline liberal churches are shrinking like crazy. Like the Episcopal Church, the United Church of Christ, all these churches, their membership is really, really dwindling, and a lot of the members are dying off. And I think one reason for that has been, and since we talked about the virtues of the progressive Christian denominations, let's talk a little bit about some of the weaknesses, because I think one of the things that happens with some of these denominations is that they tend to substitute, talk about social justice and politics and things like that for the gospel. Have you found that to be true, that some of the more liberal churches, they tend to, instead of talking about the gospel, they'll talk about, political issue or social justice issue?
As far as I have witnessed, kind of the crest of progressive evangelical Christianity is now totally oriented towards social justice and service or whatever. I mean, that's definitely like the main drive behind things. Yeah.
But do you think that's one of the reasons why the membership in some of those churches is declining? Because people want something more than that. They want something that they want the gospel. They want something spirit. They don't want to just hear some political sermon.
I don't know.
Because the fact is that a lot of those churches really are declining in membership. So, I mean, the question is why. I mean, I think one reason is because they had their heyday in a time when people grew up. They just grew up. They kind of, how do I put this? In America, there was kind of in the 40s and 50s in particular. There was in the 30s and 40s. There was kind of a unified culture and the mainline churches were kind of spreading that culture. It was being spread in the congregational churches and the United Church of Christ and the Disciples of Christ and the Presbyterians, and there just aren't as many non-denominational churches are growing a lot more quickly, a lot faster than say the Methodist church down the street or whatever. I mean, I don't know of many Methodist mega churches. But the non-denominational churches tend to be more conservative. But I think one reason they're growing is not because conservatism is better than liberalism or anything like that. I think one reason they're growing is because a lot of the conservative churches, and this is one of the things I think they do well that we could really learn from, there is something to the whole born-again experience. Take the atonement thing out of it, okay? There is something to the whole idea of, having a personal relationship with Jesus Christ. And that's where I think, and I think that they're filling a real need by introducing people to that. And I think that's one of the reasons why they're growing.
Yeah, well, and I think another thing is people of my generation are just a lot less interested in denominations in general.
I agree.
You know, it's more of a, yeah, it's more of, I guess, kind of a socialization opportunity. And some of maybe what you consider to be these more conservative churches just have these awesome worship services and everybody gets together and, like, really has a great time worshiping, and then it's cool people, you know?
Mm. Are you there?
Yeah, we're all here.
Okay.
Yeah, my phone just said low battery. I don't know if you could hear what I was just saying.
No, I heard you, yeah. Well, I found it interesting that, you know, earlier you said that we needed to, that the Urantia group needed to develop a culture, and I had to chuckle to myself because cult is in that word, culture. And, of course, you know, there's a hysteria about cults, and we know that there are all kinds of cults. There are corporate cults, secular cults, Christian cults, and Christianity is a huge cult with Jesus as its figurehead. What could be wrong with that, you know? But people can twist that into something else. That's a toxic culture, and I think that's what people are afraid of when they talk about cults.
But remember, too, Paula, that the word cult, even in the Urantia book, is not always used negatively. There's a place where they talk about
it. Well, that's my point, Andre.
Yeah.
That's the point I'm trying to make.
Yeah.
That, you know, you said we need to, or Jonathan said we should develop a culture, and the fact that we haven't, you know, it just struck me as ironic that we get called the UFO cult or the book cult. We really, I agree with you, Jonathan, we do need to develop a culture that has some more richness to it. I think part of our problem is that we're all spread out. And we, you know, unlike Christianity, for instance, just take Christianity as an example, where you have community churches. And a whole community can grow and flourish around that place. They can grow where they're planted right there, and they can serve each other, and they can help each other, and they can do things together. And in a way, the early Christian church developed just that way. The early believers were groups of people in a location. They were very nearby each other, and they hung together. What we have are people all over the planet, like Kevin in Tokyo. Kevin, God bless you, brother. He's on the board right now. Who don't have anybody to talk to.
Well, this is the point I was trying to make earlier. Maybe I didn't make it clearly enough, was that Andre was asking about what we have to gain from Christianity, and it's just that. Like, me and my brother are, you know, we're the only, like, true, you know, reader believers in this area, but we do have a community and a culture that we're kind of married to, you know, and I kind of see it as like a grafting from Christian culture. And my point is that we don't have to create a whole new culture for the Urantia movement. It can be grafted on, you know, other religious traditions. And,
yes, absolutely.
And I think I'd love
to see that happen someday, John. I'd love to see, what I hope happens eventually is that we'll see, you know, Urantian Mormonism, Urantian Christianity, Urantian Buddhism, you know. That's what I would love to see, and then to see those different expressions of, you know, how those different faiths will integrate the revelation into their existing cultures. I think that would just be so interesting, because I don't think that those, I mean, yeah, some religions do die off, but I don't think that the revelators want all these religious traditions to go away because you know they have a lot to contribute.
But
no,
I mean,
no way. I can't believe they want them to go away. They want them to evolve.
Yes, exactly.
Esther on the board just put the definition of cult up. It's great. It says cult, a group or sect bound together by veneration of the same thing, person, ideal, etc. And, you know, I have to add that I really believe that the Urantia book builds on Judeo-Christian background. It primarily builds on that foundation. And it tells us, the Midwayers tell us in part four, that Christianity is the cocoon in which the religion of Jesus will emerge. Now, we're talking about earlier about the religion of Jesus being what he called the religion of the spirit, the religion of personal spiritual experience. And so, you know, I feel very strongly that we need to reach out to Christianity. I think we can't help but reach out to all religions, and I think the Urantia book can help anybody, no matter what religion they are. It can build on their foundation, no matter what they're coming from. But clearly, the book has chosen the Judeo-Christian foundation to build upon. Would you agree on that, Jonathan? How do you feel?
Yeah, well, it's no different than how Jesus built on the, you know, the Jewish tradition. I mean, that's definitely like the stream of, you know, evolving religion that has kind of reached the highest. But I did want to kind of respond to what both you were saying. Andre, you mentioned like Urantian Christian. I have kind of explored that possibility a little bit, and at least, you know, with the Christian community. And I found it to be somewhat incompatible, Urantian Christian. But what I have found, if there is going to be a possibility, is I love the term that the book introduces, Jesusonian. And so what I've found with Christians is that I can't pretend that I can be a Christian with you, and I don't expect you to be a Urantian with me, but we can both be Jesusonian.
Okay, but you know what? Okay, and I understand what you're saying. On the other hand, though, I have a right to call myself a Christian. No one has a right to tell me that I'm not a Christian, you know, because I may be considered a heretic by some Christians. But, you know, the fact is, and I mentioned this to you before, Jonathan, that a lot of the concepts in the Urantia book are borrowed from Christian writers that were, you know, liberal Protestant Christian writers that were, you know, around in the early part of the 20th century. So, you know, yeah, more conservative groups would consider them heretics. But, you know, I just think that kind of stuff is going to depend on. The interesting thing is, you know, even though we need to develop a culture, I agree with that. But the fact is, though, that even within Christianity, it's probably more accurate to call it Christianities, plural, because there are so many, you know, why do you think we have so many denominations? Because there are so many different, you know, it's not as unified as people
think. Andre, we're having a hard time hearing you sometimes.
Oh,
can you
okay. I probably
slow
need
down
to.
Just a little?
Okay, I'm sorry. Can you hear me better now?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. I had my face away from the phone. Sorry about that. Anyway, no, I was saying that, you know, I think that we need to recognize that, that, you know, it's probably more accurate to talk about Christianities, plural, rather than Christianity, because there are so many different, you know, communities and sects. I mean, there might be some communities where they would still, you know, still be willing to call you a Christian. And I think, and I guess for me, what's more important is not so much how the whole community sees me as much as, you know, my one-on-one relationships with individual people. I mean, if, you know, there are some Christians I know who would say that I'm not a Christian and others who would say that I am, you know, and, you know, but it's really ultimately between me and God. That's really the ultimate, you know, so.
Very true. I would hope that the world in general will get over labels of any kind, because for me a label is a way to disqualify somebody. And ultimately, and I know Kristlyn supports the interfaith movement, and I support the interfaith movement. I think it's what you've been saying, Jonathan. We can come to a place where we say, and I have experienced this, especially at the Parliament of the World's Religions, I honor the God in you. And I honor the path that he has you on. And I believe that he will get you there. I have faith in the God in you to get you where he needs to get you. And I don't need to convert you to anything. If you ask me what I believe, I will tell you unabashedly what I believe. I'm proud of my spiritual path in terms of, you know, I feel like I earned it. I feel like I earned the right to say, I've read this book and it's changed my life. And I've earned the right to share that with people. I don't want to convert them to anything. I want to share my religious life with them, and I want them to share theirs with me. And I think that, you know, if the world could just get there, but obviously that, you know, there's still a lot of people on this planet who are very superstitious. I mean, we have a dear friend in Africa who took his book home with him from the parliament 5 years ago, and his aunt wouldn't let him live in the same house with her. She was so superstitious of the book for fear that it would bring bad mojo, you know?
Yeah.
So we live in a world that's so diverse, and it's such a dichotomy that's existing all at the same time. It seems to me like all seven planetary epochs are here at once.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, to respond specifically about Christianity and Andre, earlier in my dialogue with my community, I wrote an article for the school newspaper about what Christianity looks like if you define it as striving to be Christ-like. If a Christian is someone that's striving to be Christ-like. And the point I made was that, well, if you look at what Jesus taught in the Bible, the way Jesus describes God, it may or may not mean believing in Paul or believing in the Bible as canon. You know, that you can still be Christian or you can still be a follower of Christ and not believe these things. And what I eventually came to realize is that's not what Christianity is. Christianity is not striving to be Christ-like.
What is
overall
not what Christianity is?
What's that? Well, but I'll make a positive statement. Being Christian is believing in Jesus and believing in the Bible, believing in Paul. And sure, maybe there are some exceptions to that, but overall, like at least in the dialogue that I've had with my Christian community, it has gotten to the point where if I tell people that I'm a Christian, they assume I believe in biblical authority. And so it's kind of gotten to the point where it's like, well, no, I don't believe in biblical authority, and I disagree with, you know, Paul on certain issues or whatever. But what I can say is, oh, well, I believe in Jesus. And Jesus says, or Paul says a lot of things that Jesus doesn't say. And so I guess I've kind of gotten to the point where I've quit trying to disassociate Paul and biblical authority with Christianity. It kind of seems like it's there to stay. And so that's why I am affirming using the term Jesusonian more, because it's saying, well, for some people that maybe aren't as into biblical authority or aren't as into Paul but are definitely into Jesus, you know, let's find commonality in the religion that Jesus teaches, even according to the New Testament. So, Andre, you have, I don't know if you've really talk through issues of, like, biblical authority with your Christian community.
Oh, absolutely. But see, my point, of course, and they would consider the ones who really are strongly believe in biblical authority would tell me that I'm not a Christian. But I guess my point is there's many definitions of Christianity as there are Christians. I mean, it's like there are people who thought Jesus wasn't a good Jew. You know, there probably were people who thought Jesus wasn't, you know, of course, with Jew it's a little harder because you're born a Jew, you know. It's kind of a little, but the thing is, you know, the point is, I think that these definitions evolve, and I think that, you know, hopefully 100 years from now, as the Erasure book gains more circulation, you'll be able to call yourself a Christian, in more Christian circles, and still reject parts of, you know, parts of Paul and parts of, you know.
Yeah, I recognize that as a potential, just like on a practical level, as far as like the term is defined. I think it still more or less means that you believe in biblical authority, but I would love for the term Christian to not necessarily include that at some point in the future.
You know, there are people who call themselves Christians who I would not even consider Christian, who are more liberal than you and I are. I mean, there are people who call themselves Christians like, you know, like Bishop Spong. I'm not even sure if Bishop Spong believes in the resurrection of Jesus. You know, so I mean, I guess it's just a very, I guess it's a label issue again. It's what Paula was saying about labels. You know, I guess it's not, I personally like the term Christian and don't feel like I should have to drop it just because, you know, just because I believe in the Ransom Book. And I guess the reason I feel that way is because, you know, it's funny. I think it was you guys were both talking about how the Ransom Book builds on the Judeo-Christian foundation. You were saying, Jonathan, about how Jesus, about it's just like Jesus building on Judaism. Well, you know, there's a line that I love. I always like to bring this up, where Jesus says, "I've not come to take away that which you had from your forefathers, but to give you the perfected vision of that which they saw only in part." And I think that that's true of the Urantia book. You know, it's not come to the book did not come to take away from that which you know from our Christian tradition or whatever tradition you come from. It's to give the give you the perfected vision of that which your forefathers saw only in part. So I guess that's how I would look at it.
Well, can we take another call?
Absolutely. And by the way, before we get the caller, let me just also, I know you guys have the number on the screen, but I want to just do my host duty and point out that the number is to call in is 646-716-8158. That's 646-716-8158.
Okay, so 603, you're on the Cosmic Citizen.
Hi, Jonathan. It's Reed. How you doing?
Hi.
Good. How are you? Can you touch on any Jesusonian communities or even where the Garden Project is? Or am I getting off subject here?
What was your question about Jesus? Are there Jesusonian communities?
Yeah.
I don't know any communities that use that term to define themselves, but I can just speak to my relationship, me and my brother's relationship with our community, which is Christian, in saying that we have been able to find commonality in saying, oh, this, you know, service project that we're doing is very Jesusonian. It doesn't have to be like a competition between your Urantian and Christian. Like, we can both rest in, you know, common identity of in certain cases or certain examples. Like, I wouldn't define it as an all-out community, but maybe it's like the seed of a culture, you know, that's being cultivated. But being able to identify certain qualities of experiences or teachings or whatever as being Jesusonian, and knowing that, okay, you believe in the atonement doctrine, I don't. You believe in biblical authority, I believe in the Urantia book. Yet we can both believe in things that are Jesusonian. So maybe that doesn't answer your question. I mean, no, I don't know.
I was thinking more of communities of like-minded individuals. You know, in and around the Urantia book, you know, like communes living together, you know.
I'd love to see something like that, but I haven't found any.
Well, I hear that there's some people in South America. I don't know too much about it, in Chile, doing something like that. But.
And
how is the Garden Project going?
I'm sorry, what was that?
Gabriel of Urantia is a long-standing Urantian commune of a sort, but it's not necessarily an open commune. I would like to see more intentional communities of Urantia book readers. Boulder has a great Urantia book community, and we study and worship together, and we support each other, and we are a real community, not unlike a church community, and I would say that that's because we've had two wonderful Urantia book readers who've spent the last 30 years doing nothing but trying to build community in this area, and that's Mo Siegel and John Hay. So that's really what it takes. It takes committed people really working to coalesce a community.
Yeah, and speaking of Jesusonian communities, I just thought of, to answer your question, a community that wouldn't call themselves Jesusonian, but from my perspective, the most Jesusonian community I've witnessed was a traditional Mennonite community that I stayed with for a while in Belize. They live, you know, they don't use electricity or like gas-powered engines or anything, and they live an agrarian lifestyle, and they were the most sweet-spirited, I guess, Jesusonian folk that I've met and lived out on such a big scale. I think it's like 20 households or something, and they, if someone's sick, they take a collection and everybody throws in money to fly them to get surgery or I guess bus them up to the U.S. to get surgery, or if somebody's behind on their farm work, they all kick in and help out, build each other's houses and stuff. It's traditional Mennonite, but as far as wafting of Jesusonianism, that is a community that I've witnessed. I consider to be somewhat of a model in my mind.
Do they have the Urantia book, or are they more biblical based? Or
oh yeah, they're old school biblical based. Definitely. I mean, it's a community that's like comes from the Reformation. It's like a 400 or 500 year old tradition. They've been living that way.
That is, in a sense, people used to have to come together like that to survive. Nobody could survive like an island, you know. If you were a hermit and you went off by yourself, your chances of survival weren't as great as if you bound together with a community of like-minded people and had a support system. And so I think that was more the norm, and it has become, with the advent of cars, we have tended to isolate ourselves. We don't join in community as much as we used to before we could go here, there, or everywhere. And so, you know, Tom Choquette, I don't know if you guys all know Tom, but he's an amazing person. He said something to me recently that just really struck me. He said, you know, Paula, we're the people of the box. He said, we live in a box. We go out every morning and get in our box and go to another box so we can sit in a smaller box and look at a box. And then when we're done looking at that box, we get back in our box and come home to our box and another small box where we lay down and look at a box. He said,
boxes.
So we're the people of the box. And and then I thought, wow, there's something about what he said that really intrigued me, because it's become real vogue to say that we're thinking outside the box. And, you know, really what the box represents for me is our isolation.
But you know what? Call me the quintessential optimist, but I think that I think we have an opportunity, though, today to have more community than people in the past did, because people in the past were forced by necessity to live in close proximity to one another. But there was also a lot of oppression in that kind of lifestyle. As we talked before, there's a lot of authoritarianism. I mean, I'm glad, for example, that we're not living in a day and age where, you know, you're forced, the only option you have is to marry the girl next door, you know. So I think that there's an opportunity for community now. On the one hand, yeah, we're all so spread out here as Urantians. That's true. On the other hand, though, I think the intentional community movement is great. I mean, I think the idea of a bunch of people, you know, of course this takes some money, I guess, but if a bunch of people just agreed, you know, a bunch of people with similar values just agreed that we're all going to rent apartments in the same complex, or we're all going to buy condos in the same complex, or we're all going to buy houses in the same neighborhood, you know. To me, that's real community, because it's not community based on necessity. It's community that's based on choice, and it's community that's based on a set of common values. It's not something you're doing because you're forced to do it for survival.
Someone is breathing in the mic, and some of the people on the board can hear it. So.
Yeah, I can hear it too.
Well, it might be me. I'm
it's
actually outside and it's a little windy.
Oh, okay. Maybe that's it. It's wind.
No. Anyway, I was just saying though that the new community, I think the opportunity for community today is even greater because it's not just based on survival. It's not just coming from necessity. It's coming from choice and from, you know, people who have values in common, not just because they, you know, grew up in the same neighborhood or whatever.
Jonathan. Yeah, well, this Mennonite community that I stayed with, I mean, they have such strong common spiritual beliefs. I mean, what defined them as a community during the Reformation was that they believed that religion should be a personal experience, a choice. And they were bitterly persecuted from it. They thought when the Reformation was happening, it would be their opportunity to have real religious freedom. But the religious authority of the different states, you know, the German state or whatever, the Northern European states, just took the place of the, you know, the Catholic Church. And they were persecuted by both Catholics and Protestants because they believed in the second baptism, you know, that it should be a personal decision. Maybe at first, like, they banded together because of persecution, but they have, like, carried on down, you know, through all these generations, still kind of maintaining the same values. I think not using cars and stuff, like, definitely has an effect on their community, but it's not, I mean, they have shown that there's a force at work behind, a cohesive force behind them, that, you know, transcends even the box era, you know, that we're entering. And what that is, I think, is a true spirit of love and selflessness and service that you find so evident in their community that regardless of, you know, whether cars or whatever take over the highways, like, they're able to maintain that community. That has to be the foundation of any community. It can't be, with the Urantia movement, it can't be mere intellectual commonality. Common belief in the Urantia book is not strong enough to maintain a community.
Absolutely. It has to be
a relationship with God, individually and, you know, collectively.
Okay, but here's the thing, Jonathan. You know, you've talked about the importance of us creating, you know, having, you know, that we need to develop a culture, or a culture needs to develop. Do you think one reason, though, we're having a hard time with that is because, do you think maybe we're too individualistic in the movement? Let me explain what I mean by that. Because you said both personally and collectively. We had one person on the show once who said, don't say we believe such and such. This person said, you know, say I believe or you believe. Says, you know, we don't have a creed here. We don't have a, you know, and there's such a strong emphasis on my individual personal relationship with God. It becomes a fine line between religion being personal and religion being private. You know, I believe religion is supposed to be personal, but I don't think that it's supposed to be private. You know, I mean, Jesus tells you, you know, don't to hide your light under a bushel. Okay, so. You know, there's, you know, when the, I think there maybe what's happened is, you know, people take statements like from the Urantia book and says things like, religion is wholly a matter of personal experience, and people see that and they'll think, well, it's wholly a matter of, it's just between me and God, so I don't have to. So do you think, I've actually heard people, you know, I've heard Urantia book readers object to people praying with other people, to people praying out loud. Now this is getting better. Don't get me wrong. This is a lot worse 20 years ago. But there still seems to be a little undercurrent of that in the movement where people think, well, you know, my relationship with God is my relationship with God. I don't need to share it with anybody else. Have you run into that at all, do you think, in the movement? And do you think if that's the case, do you think that maybe that's part of the reason why we're struggling to build community in the movement?
Yeah, definitely. I don't really think it's a problem. I mean, the last thing we need to do is, you know, constrain people to certain
right
religious forms they're not comfortable with. But further than that, like, when I look at the Urantia community, I don't assume that it's a religious community. Like, it's an intellectual community. Like, the thing that's bonding us together is the fact that we believe or at least we read the same book. And perhaps a religious community will sprout out of that, you know, intellectual soil, out of that, you know, intellectual ferment. But, I mean, your ancient community really can't be qualified as a religious community until real religion naturally and spontaneously comes to life in that intellectual setting. And there is an inclination to try to, like, centralize or organize religious movements, like, within the rancher community, and there's a lot of resistance to it. And I think that's okay. Eventually, it's going to happen naturally. It's going to, forms are going to, you know, leaders are going to rise up, forms will be adopted, and it'll happen spontaneously. And there's no rush to impose it, as far as I'm concerned.
I have to agree with you, Jonathan, because I think we're evolving. And when I look at us, when I try to view us through the eyes of the Spirit, what I see are a transitional community. We are transitioning from the old way of being to a new way of being. You know, we were talking about community and we were talking about being able to travel from place to place. But on the other hand, the Urantia book says that travel will allow us to achieve world peace. Why? Because we'll get to know other communities and we will lose our enmity towards the others because now we know them, we understand them. And because we know and understand them, we will come to love them. And only travel and a global language, a way to talk to one another, a way to get to know each other. So it's all about getting to know each other. And in a way, we are breaking down all the boundaries that hold us apart. We are truly becoming a global community. The very fact that, you know, people meet online from all over the world like we're doing today, like we do every Saturday. We're becoming a global community. We're breaking down the barriers and we're getting to know each other even though we can't be in the same physical location. And that's all a good thing. But there's it's like Jesus said in his instruction for teachers and believers. He said, "Forewarn all believers of the fringe of conflict that must be traversed as they go from one life as it is lived in the material to the life that is lived in the spirit." And in a way, we are transitioning. Our community, your Rancher Book readers, we have something brand new, and it's showed us a way to look at things that hasn't been shown to humans before. So we have this knowledge, and yet we still have to stay in the world that we're in and apply this knowledge to in a practical way to the problems that we have right now. And we have people in communities, just like you've experienced, like Andre's experienced, who would say we are of the devil. We know we're not of the devil, but they don't know that. You know, we have other problems on the planet, obviously so pressing right now. The very air we breathe, the planet we live on, we're all trying to become conscious of the issues that are in front of us, and we're trying to learn how to live together. I think the whole globe is realizing we're interdependent. We can no longer say we're Americans. I mean, that's okay, geographically speaking, but in reality, we're world citizens. And what we do has an effect on the rest of the world. We can't live anymore like it doesn't. And just the very name of this show, Cosmic Citizens, the truth of the matter is we are cosmic citizens. And the universe is trying to get us to come back into the embrace of the friendly, well-ordered universe. We're a discord with it right now. But they're trying to show us the way back. So we're in this transition, and it's very difficult. And we have to let it evolve. We can't put ready-made forms upon it. We just have to let it evolve. And I think that's about keeping one foot, you know, staying grounded, keeping one foot here and one foot there. You know, it's like a bridge. Jesus said, this life is a bridge. You can pass over it, but you shouldn't think to build a dwelling place upon it. You know, so that's about perspective. And sometimes allowing evolution to happen is difficult. We want to hold each other in the past, or we want to slingshot each other into the future. But it's really about both, and that's where we're trying to find a balance.
Yeah, I have kind of two counterpoised experience. Like, my community here, which is mostly from a Christian background, is my spiritual community. It's where I'm spiritually fed, even though there's not intellectual unity, there's spiritual unity. And I'm trying to cultivate, you know, intellectual growth amongst my community from, you know, what we has been revealed to us in the Urantia book. And then on the other side is the Urantia community is an intellectual community of mine, you know, that I have intellectual unity with, but I haven't quite found spiritual unity with. Like, I think in the Urantia movement, we can work towards cultivating, you know, spirit associations, spirit communities, because the foundation is intellectual. So it's kind of like going back and forth between the two, you know, cultivating ourselves spiritually in the movement, and then going back to my spiritual community, which is mostly Christian, and trying to cultivate that intellectually.
Wow, that's, you know, you're like, your experience, that seesaw experience, that back and forth experience, I so resonate with that, because that's exactly what was going on. When I was, 20 years ago, when I first discovered the Urantia book, actually a little over 20 years ago, I would go to Urantia book study groups, and it would be an intellectual head trip, and I would get and it would be interesting to me, but I would come out of the study group feeling kind of cold, like, gee, you know, I feel like I'm not really getting my spiritual needs met. And I'd go to a Christian church, and I'd praise God and worship with people, and they talked about what God did for them this week, you know. I was like, why can't we have this in the Urantia movement, you know? And so I think what one of the things that I think I mentioned this to you, John, I went through a period where I did not believe in the Urantia book for a while. I rejected the book for about 10 years. And I think one of the reasons is because I wasn't getting my spiritual needs met among the Urantia community. And so, but I have to say it, things really are getting better. They really are. I mean, I've actually gotten people in my area, you know, to pray out loud, to sing, to do things that they just wouldn't have done before, ever. And I just think that, I do think that we're evolving towards, you know, the right direction.
I think the conference in Boulder, I've only been to 3 conferences. That was my third. But that definitely was more of a spiritual. I felt more spiritual at that conference than any other conference I've been to. Like, we had these breakout sessions that Mike McIsaac kind of had us do, where we gathered together in little groups just for spiritual conversation. And that was really fulfilling.
Yeah, I agree.
I think that we have to make room for that spontaneity so that we can talk to each other and not just at each other all the time, you know? And that's when the move, so... I did. I really enjoyed that too, Jonathan, and I was really glad Michael did that. Well, you know,
I was going to say it's an adventure. You know, it's like we have an opportunity to. We were talking about kind of creating a culture. I kind of view it more as cultivating a culture. Like, we're still so early in the community, like. What an opportunity we have to be creative and spontaneous in discovering, like, unifying forms of worship and spiritual edification, you know. And you catch hints of it here and there at conferences, like when we had those little sessions. And I don't know, like, kind of a call out to the artists out there, you know. Like, Tato Banton has done a lot of great stuff, and that's kind of come to define our culture a little bit, you know, Pato Banton's reggae music. And I don't know, it's an adventure to come up with different forms of worship.
But you know, what though, John, I don't think it's going to just be one call. I think that you're going to see now, hopefully it won't be divided like it is in Christendom, but I think you're going to see various forms of worship and various forms. I mean, you're going to see some of your rancher communities that are more Christian, more, and then
some
that are more, some that are more Buddhist, some that are more, you know, that's, and that's, frankly, that's as it should be, I think.
Because I
don't think it should be, I don't think that, you know, it should be this homogenized thing, you know, where everybody, you know, we don't want that. We don't want uniformity. We want, you know, and I think, I look forward to the day when, you know, you'll have several conferences going on at the same time, you know, around the world, and some, and they'll all have their own unique cultural expression, you know, and that probably will happen, you know, way beyond my lifetime. But, you know, that's what we need to strive for, I think.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's to me, it's interesting to watch it evolve, and to help it evolve, and to hold up my perspective and my truth, and to listen to the truth and perspective of others, because we all hold a piece, you know, of it. And I think that, you know, we do, your point about being between two worlds, Jonathan, about, you know, the intellectual and the spiritual, and that did remind me of Andre, because he has said that many times, and certainly we can get better at that. Jesus said, you know, the mind is not the seat of the spirit, but it is indeed the intellect, not the mind, sorry. He said the intellect is not the seat of the spirit, but it is indeed the gateway thereto. And I don't think we want to get stuck in the gateway, you know? And a lot of people I know that are stuck in their intellect are stuck in the gateway. And Jesus said over and over again that the kingdom of heaven is in the hearts of men. And I think that's, you know, not meaning the physical heart, although I think the physical heart is a representation of that, because it is the feeling, perceiving mechanism. I mean, you feel with your heart, and when you allow your heart to lead, now you're leading with love and caring, and you're thinking first about the you know, you're letting people know how much you care, and you're leading with that, and you're allowing yourself to feel compassion and empathy for your fellow man. And I think that humanity has stayed out of their heart largely because of the terrible things we've done to each other. If we were in our hearts, we certainly couldn't make war.
Paula, I think Jonathan just dropped off by accident. I need to get him back on.
Okay.
Hold on a second. I'll do that.
Sure.
Go ahead.
Well, we lost Jonathan, folks, but we'll get him back. Christy, are you still there? Crystalline? Well, I have somebody on. That's all one. Andre?
Yeah, I'm still trying to get him. Hold on.
Okay. Now, Lou just brought up on the board, thank you, Lou, that this is the perfect opportunity to mention that there is a conference coming up in Chicago at the end of this month. And it's at the Dominican University. It's the theme of the conference is God. Jonathan, are you there?
I don't think so. You know what? I think that he may have. I wonder if his cell phone died or something.
He may have run out of battery.
Yeah, because I'm getting his voicemail right away as soon as I.
Oh, yeah.
So it's probably what happened. How are we doing on time, Paula?
Well, we only have 11 minutes, Andre,
okay.
And I was just making
a
plug for the conference at the end of the month in Chicago, Illinois, at Dominican University. Oh My God Consciousness, or God Consciousness, a Living University.
Mm.
And it's going to be a great conference. It's a fellowship summer seminar. We do it every summer. We've had it at Dominican 3 times now. It's a great university. Looks kind of like Hogwarts. Beautiful old university with a real high energy. And so go online to the fellowship's website if you want to find out more about it. It's www.yourranchabook.org. And you'll find out how to get there. And what to do if you want to attend.
Absolutely, and I will be there. I'll be doing a workshop there. Resting in the Arms of God is my topic, and I'm really, really looking forward to that conference too. I really need the boost, the spiritual booster shot thing going, you know. So I'm really, really looking forward to that.
We try to keep it affordable too, friends. It's you know, it ends up costing about $300 for to attend the whole conference. That's for a program. And food and board, or room and board. So if you want to come, please do. It'll be a high time for everybody, a high spiritual time. I should qualify that. And it's sad that we lost our guest, but, you know, Andre, as you point out all the time, that's talk radio, folks. People's cell phone batteries run out. Maybe
yep.
Jonathan will find a way to call us back in, but if he doesn't, I just want to say thanks, bro. You did a great job as a guest, and it was wonderful having you on, Jonathan.
Absolutely.
Always sad when we don't get to say goodbye to a friend, but
absolutely. So I want to just also put in a plug for our show next week. We're going to have Susan Isaacs on, who is she's actually a Christian comedian. She's done some interesting things. She's got a book out called Angry Conversations with God. So that should be interesting. It's kind of instead of Neil Walsh's Conversations with God, it's Angry Conversations with God. But it should be interesting. She's not a Your Answer Book reader. She's going to be one of our outside-the-box guests, which we haven't done in a while. And so I'm really looking forward to that. And it should be an interesting, and I'm looking forward to reading the book, too, which I'll be doing this week as well. So
would you say that we're out of the box again, Andre?
Yeah, no, we just might be. Maybe we're not as much out of the box as we think we are, though, as Tom says. I don't know. So.
Well, this is true. And so tell us a little bit about your workshop, Andre. What are you going to be talking about?
Well, the workshop, Resting in the Arms of God, is going to be a little bit, I'm going to do some of what I did on the air a few weeks ago, where I read some of the prayers that I had done with God. The listening prayers, which are where I write a letter to God and I listen to what God says back to me and write it down. I'm gonna share my experience with that. I'm also going to provide people an opportunity to do that, to actually have some writing time, where they'll be able to spend some time with God, writing in a journal and praying. In fact, I don't know if I. Mentioned that I hope that they put that in the program, that this workshop will involve some writing, because that something people need to see. So I may have to make an announcement or something at the conference so people don't forget their notebooks or whatever it is that they're going to bring to write with. So that's kind of what I'm doing. I'm going to give a more extended testimony, and I'm going to give people a chance to do that as well. And I'm going to try to get a few passages from the Answer Book that kind of get in with this theme. My basic theme is that receiving love from God is really important, because that's how we learn to love, is by receiving love. And just like babies learn to love by receiving love, they don't learn to love by trying to love. They learn to love by receiving love from their parents. And so as we receive love from God and allow Him to fill us up with His love, then that love spills over onto other people. And as we rest in His arms and just learn to receive His love, then we can become more loving to others.
You know, amazingly simple concept, but amazingly important too. Jesus said it again in the Second Discourse on Religion. You do well to understand the reality of God, but you would do better to realize His presence.
Absolutely.
And I think it's in that realization that you're always in His presence that keeps you grounded and keeps you solid, keeps you on the path, so to speak, you know. And that's a good thing.
Yes, it is. So, well.
You know, I want to take this opportunity, since we have a few minutes and we lost our guest, to thank Reed for calling in. Reed, God bless you, man. Thanks for calling. It was great. And thank Crystalyn for calling. And say thanks to the regulars on our board and some of the new folks, too. Emerald Rose, thanks for listening. And Kevin in Tokyo, so glad to have you, man. I guess it's the middle of the night there. So it's wonderful. And Lou, always great to have you on the board. Larry, you're the best. Anne, love you, darling. Mark Erickson, wow. I'm so glad you guys call in. Bro Dave, thanks for listening every week and being a regular on our board and just a member of our little Saturday World Study Group here on the Cosmic Citizen. I really appreciate all of you guys, and I appreciate what you have to say. Try to get your questions on when I can. Somebody called in from 707 earlier, and I didn't get to take his call before we lost him. So if you're still listening, I'm sorry I didn't get to take your call. Call back in, please. That's Northern California. I looked it up.
Yes, it is.
trying to figure out who that was, but I
because I know Paul. That. Paul, I have too much time in my hands because I remember area codes.
Andre, you remember numbers like nobody I've ever met, so, you know, you're amazing to me. I don't remember numbers. I remember words, though. You remember words, too. But,
yep.
Yeah, it's really a blast every week to be with you guys and to study with you. And I hope that my dear friend J.J. Johnson, I know you guys probably know J.J., he's extraordinary. He has traveled the world. He has introduced the Urantia Book to people all over the world, literally. He's an amazing outreacher with the Urantia Book. And he said that he's in Russia now. He's stationed in Russia. He travels with his job. And he's stationed in Russia right now. And a guy that he was with the other day mentioned the Cosmic Citizen radio show to him.
Really? That's amazing.
Yeah.
Does JJ know about the show then? Did he know about the show before the guy mentioned it?
I sent him the link.
Okay.
So I don't know how it came up, but it was great. It just goes to show that we have a world study group here. And a community, an online community that's growing, and it feels really good. So thanks, everyone. Thanks for hanging with us, and thanks, Lou, for always pulling up the quotes. I'll say one, and Lou will go and find it and put it on the board. That's fantastic. I just love that. So, you know, it's really good the way it's evolving. And, Andre, you know, I wish you could see the board sometimes.
Well, I've seen the transcripts of the chat sometime. I mean, Larry sent them to me before.
I imagine it's a little hard to see the transcript. Boom Shaka, I see you, bro. Thank you, buddy. another guy on the board, Boom Shaka. You know, we have a great online community, Andre, and it's wonderful. I don't know if it's really very easy to make sense of the transcripts, is it?
No, it's doable.
It's doable, yeah.
Sure.
Because we kind of go all over the place, but, you know, and there's a delay. There's always a time delay, but it's fun. It's a gas.
Yeah.
So we're down to 2 minutes, Andre. And.
Okay, well, I actually probably should be going here because my body is telling me I need to go. Let's put it that way. So nature is calling me, so I'm going to need to take a hike here. So why don't we call it a day here? And, again, stay with us next week. We're going to be talking with Susan Isaacs on her book, Angry Conversations with God, and really look forward to that. So have a great day, everybody, and it was great to be with you guys again. And, Jonathan, again, thanks for being our guest.
Thank you, Andre. Have a great week.
You've been listening to The Cosmic Citizen, a radio program focused primarily on the study and discussion of the Urantia Book and its teachings. The Urantia Book is a religious text that claims to be written by angels and other superhuman personalities. If you are a Urantia Book reader or a spiritual seeker looking for new truth, we hope and pray you have been nourished and edified by our ministry. Please remember that the views expressed on this program do not reflect the official views and opinions of any Urantia organizations. There is no official interpretation of the Urantia Book. So all opinions expressed on this program exclusively reflect the personal biases of the hosts, guests, and callers who participate in these discussions. If you would like more information about the Arantia book, or if you just have comments or questions, please feel free to email us at cosmiccitizen@xnet.com. That's cosmiccitizen@xnet, the letter X, N-E-T.com. And remember, only a brave person is willing honestly to admit and fearlessly to face what a sincere and logical mind discovers.